It's time for another Morton's Media Group podcast. And we're delighted to be able to welcome Jack Harrison, the editor of a fantastic publication celebrating Her Majesty's landmark birthday, The Queen at 90, A Life in Pictures. Jack, first and foremost, you must be very proud of this publication.
Definitely. Very proud of the final result after the work that went into it. And even more proud being that it's my first nationally published publication, so important for me as well.
As it's a nationally produced publication, and I'm sure will be available internationally,
that's
so
correct, yes.
It's only right that we actually invite our official royal correspondent to actually join us to talk us through some of the wonderful highlights, which we'll prompt him with, as we say, The Queen at 90, A Life in Pictures. That would be, of course, Richard Fitzwilliams. Richard, welcome to our podcast.
And wonderful to talk about a milestone that really is absolutely unique. There isn't a record, of course, the Queen hasn't broken. And we are so fortunate to be living at a time when we can appreciate our sovereign approaching 90, the Duke of Edinburgh approaching 95, and still going strong. It's not been known in 1,000 years of monarchy, and it is truly remarkable.
Just to set the scene, Richard, for this, and of course of the Morton's Media Group podcast fans who might have thought, what's happened to all those podcasts that used to come through? They're all back in full force. Jack, would you like to just read from the preface? Because obviously they're your words, and I was going to think I could actually talk about when I first delved into the first archive collection. But no, Jack, just take us through the first couple of paragraphs.
I certainly can. So, Queen Elizabeth. When I delved into the first archive collection on my list to explore in preparation for this publication, I quickly came upon just short of 100,000 images captioned with those two words, and it soon became clear that whittling them down to the 400 or so needed for this publication was going to be no simple task.
Let's just hold it there, Jack, because, I mean, that sort of puts the task of Jack Harrison into perspective, really. 100,000 images having to be reduced to 400 for this publication. Richard, where would you start?
One can only say that it's an epic task, and obviously some of the choices are obvious, but some are subjective. But it's certainly not a task I'd envy. It is Sisyphean.
Well, it's broken down. I like that, using Sisyphus, then the whole notion of pushing up a rock backwards. Very good. A bit of classical illusion. Marvellous. And Jack, in terms of deciding the breakdown of the individual chapter, the first one starts with Long to Reign Over Us from that point of view, and it concludes, obviously, with the Queen's 90th year. Was that something that you wanted to take decade by decade as a structure?
It was. That seemed pretty obvious way to get going. There was a few concerns with that, though. One being that going decade by decade, you would have a lot of black and white at the start and a lot of colour at the end, which is why we introduced the Long to Reign Over Us chapter. So that looks at the major milestones in terms of the Silver Jubilee, Golden Jubilee, Diamond Jubilee, to get some sort of overarching look at the Queen,
Richard,
at the beginning, and then move into the decades.
You're in for a treat when this actually comes through. I'm currently looking at backstage at the Buckingham Palace Diamonds Jubilee Concert, Queen Elizabeth II meeting Sir Elton John, Sir Cliff Richard, Dame Shirley Bassey, Sir Tom Jones and Sir Paul McCartney.
A wonderful evening. That was truly memorable. Yeah. It really was. It was one of the great moments, one of the most unusual, too. It is possible that if it had not been for Diana, would we, for example, have had a concert of that sort? I mean, a little doubt that the monarchy is democratized, and a little doubt with the way they've embraced social media most recently, and the way they change with the times, so it might very well have happened anyway. But I saw it and loved it, and it was a terrific show.
Jumping straight ahead, and we would say there's no possible substitute for getting hold of the Queen at 90, A Life in Pictures, obviously. This is just, I mean, you know, it's a challenge in itself, Richard. I mean, Jack had the challenge of actually reducing those pictures down. Here we are delivering an audio medium to actually describe some of those pictures. But into Chapter 2, Lineage and History, and, of course, we lead with Princess Elizabeth, later Queen Elizabeth II, born April the 21st, 1926. And actually, Richard, christened Elizabeth Alexandra Mary by the Anglican Archbishop of York.
Very important, I think, that you're looking back at that time. You're also, of course, looking back at a child who had no inkling of the fact that one day she would be queen. Only this morning I was talking about the Queen's youth and also the wartime Vine show, and it's interesting to remember that the Duke of York, of course, was her father, who later George VI, was a shy man who was deeply dedicated to duty. He was a naval officer, and he had, of course, this stammer, and his brother, colourful, very much the playboy and extremely undesirable, as we've subsequently discovered, and of course the abdication in 1936 and the crisis propelling George VI and Queen Elizabeth to the throne, but also no question that a change, something that I think has greatly influenced the Queen, and that is her uncle's abdication. One of the reasons that she would never abdicate, firstly, of course, her religious faith and the oath she took, but obviously memories of a time which was very difficult for the monarchy. But you had, during the war, as symbols of freedom and resistance, the king and queen, and that was tremendously important. Important also to remember the young princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret, at Windsor Castle at that time, and also, of course, the queen is the only surviving head of state who saw service in the war, the auxiliary territorial service.
Well, I'm particularly taken, Jack and Richard, with a couple of pictures and images on page 23 and 24. Page 23, we have the Duke and Duchess of York holding one-year-old Princess Elizabeth on the balcony of Buckingham Palace on June 27th, 1927. And then we have the Queen Consort, Queen Mary, shading the youngster with an umbrella, with King George V standing behind his granddaughter. And then on the subsequent page, we have Princess Elizabeth being taken for a ride around the grounds of Windsor Castle with her cousin Gerald Lascelles, the son of Princess Mary, also in 1927. And what you've created here, Jack, is very much it's a time-travelling scenario because, you know, we're looking at something, as you say, 90 years ago. Phenomenal.
Yeah, very much so. And looking through the pictures and doing the research, I found absolutely fascinating myself putting it together, and hopefully that's going to come across for what I hope is many, many readers.
I mean, from your own perspective, Richard, looking at some of this early material, which I have to say the reproduction is phenomenal. It's page 25, Princess Elizabeth staying close to her mother's side as they walk through London's Lounge Square in June 1929, the upmarket area of Belgravia, home to the Earl of Strathmore, grandfather to Princess Elizabeth. That's a fascinating information. Do you find, Richard, that actually, when it comes to this, apart from folk who kind of would be ardent monarchists, you know, people often forget that very human story that clearly the royal family have kind of manifested, and Her Majesty the Queen in particular, over the last nine decades?
Well, there is the human element, of course, because they're royal. It is very much the royal goldfish bowl. So in those days, of course, you could control royal images, and they could do so pretty ruthlessly. Today we know how difficult it is with arranged photo opportunities, and if they don't exist, then there are complaints, and then there is a debate as to how much coverage the monarchy should have, and so forth. And also, to what extent, I mean, you've got William and you've got Kate, and they're determined that George and Charlotte will grow up in with as much affection, as much attention, and about as much privacy as is humanly possible. In those days of which you speak, pre-war, I mean, clearly this was not an issue at all, and it wasn't even in the 1950s, but it was especially with the encroachment of Murdoch and the tabloid press towards the end of the 1960s and into the 1970s, that members of the royal family, of course, had to be extremely careful. And nowadays, of course, with Flickr, Twitter, Facebook, and every form of social media, and as Prince Harry discovered, not to let those who aren't close friends and intimates into your parties in Las Vegas. So it's given the town an even livelier reputation after he was there.
Jack, from your analysis side of things, I mean, Richard just mentioned the social media. One wonders how the abdication crisis, featured, of course, on page 31, and the declaration of war with King George VI's radio address on September 3rd, 1939, would have flashed on that. I mean, what did you sort of make of that sort of area? Because in one ways, these are really close sort of aspects and clear historical perspectives. Well, and as Richard just said, could be quite interesting how it would be dealt with in contemporary society.
Yeah, most certainly. I mean, the birth of Princess Elizabeth is probably the prime example. I mean, very little public fanfare to greet it, and then you compare that with obviously the birth of Prince George just a few years ago, and I mean, you couldn't move for news of that and pictures of that and everything else.
People were waiting outside the hospital.
Precisely.
Wait has become somewhat notorious, but because he is second in line the wait has become somewhat notorious, but because he is third in line to the throne, this is probably unsurprising. But you noticed when Princess Charlotte was born, a similar arrangement outside St. Mary's. I mean, matters were handled in a different way.
October the 13th, 1940, Richard. A key element, particularly given with the medium that we're actually producing this podcast.
Ah, yes, broadcasting. Exactly. I know the first broadcast that Princess Elizabeth made to the children of the Empire with Princess Margaret, and it was considered a great success, and certainly it had a sort of appeal. It's important to remember that in 1932, George V had inaugurated the Empire Service with a broadcast. It had been written by Rudyard Kipling. It was a suggestion of Lord Reith, who was the head of the BBC, and it was considered such a success that although Edward VIII never made one, and it was and these were agonizing. We saw this in the King's speech, of course, which has spread the word of the problems the King faced in this area, helped by Lionel Lowe, the speech therapist. But it was a real agony for George VI to do. And there was the famous 1939 one where he also quoted a poem by Minnie Louise Haskins about the man who stood the gate of the year. And that really, really was tremendously popular. And the October 1940 broadcast by the Princess was considered, I mean, of its sort. It really did work, and it was a lovely idea.
And although, from a sporting perspective, it's clear that Her Majesty's got more fondness for horse racing. It's not as much as her mum, but that's lying through. We see on page 41 that on April 30th, 1949, it was indeed Princess Elizabeth who presented Wolverhampton Wanderers captain Billy Wright with the FA Cup trophy following Wolves' 3-1 win over Leicester City, proving that even in this contemporary time, Leicester City doing well in the league.
Goodness me, I mean, it's interesting, a number of years that you've missed out there, the way things moved on with the famous VE and V-Day, and when they slipped out of the palace, and so famously.
Well, we won't talk about that movie, Richard, because I know it's not a big...
To mention
no.
I wasn't going to lower the tone.
Exactly.
But also, of course, by then, Princess Elizabeth had married Prince Philip, and he will appear, I'm sure, in numerous photographs.
Curious enough. Page 42, Jack. And again, your decision with respect to what to select from the point of view of the Queen and Prince Philip, meriting its own chapter, of course.
Indeed, yeah. Well, I say, the book is laid out in decades, but sort of interspersed in that, and to break up that flow, there are a few specialised chapters, and the Queen and Prince Philip is one of them. It's certainly, I think it's an obvious decision to dedicate a chapter to that subject, and some of the photos in there are fascinating.
Well, certainly, I'm looking at one taken from Clarence House on August the 8th, 1951. The Duke of Edinburgh holding the newest addition to the royal family, Princess Anne, with Princess Elizabeth, of course, and Prince Charles joining the royal family photo. And looking actually for its time, and I suspect it looks very Cecil Beaton-esque, but actually it looks fairly natural. It doesn't look too posed at all, that particular
image. Cecil Beaton was a master when it came to the posed photograph. There's absolutely no doubt at all that, for example, when Queen Elizabeth was, so to speak, altering the royal image, which was so important prior to the war, Cecil Beaton did a series of glorious poses which made her look very statuesque, and they worked beautifully. And then, of course, Beaton's coronation photographs have become legendary. But he certainly did, if the image was posed, he was in his element. But there are, of course, vast variety in Beaton's output, and he was a master of the trade.
We'll run through some of the dates of birth of the rest of the firm, as indeed it has been referred to. Charles, of course, Prince of Wales, born November the 14th, 1948. Anne, Princess Royal, born August the 15th, 1950. And then slightly later, Prince Andrew, Duke of York, born February the 19th, 1960, with Prince Edward, Earl of Wessex, born March the 10th, 1964.
And it's interesting that when you're moving into the new decades, from the 50s, which, I mean, there were one or two incidences of or change. There was the glorious coronation, of course, which was one of the most fabulous spectacle I think ever staged, no doubt at all, in 1953, the Queen acceding on the death of her father, who died so tragically young, and worn out by the war too, no doubt that took its toll in 1952. You had occasional criticisms, so rare that they were news, but it was in the 1950s, the royal image and an age still of deference was about to be shattered, of course, by a great deal of change which was so characteristic of the 1960s. And then, of course, you had media intrusion. But then one of the things in the 1960s that fascinates me is that the only institution, establishment institution, that was so resistant to the winds of change was, of course, the royal family, because they fought back superbly with the film The Royal Family, which we can't see anymore because it was realized the access was so intimate, and also with the investiture of the Prince of Wales, which historically nonsense, but very spectacular.
And yet, there are a number of images here, Jack, that I think particularly show the human side of Her Majesty. One on page 57 of the 1956 Stockholm Equestrian Games, Queen Elizabeth II gasping as a mount slips during the dressage section, Princess Margaret, Richard looking on with cigarette holder in hand. Wonderful.
Yes, well, that was a characteristic of the princess.
Indeed. And then latterly, on July the 1st, 1958, miners at Rothes Colliery in Scotland looking on as Queen Elizabeth II donning white overalls, scarf, helmet and black gum boots to make her first visit to a coal mine. Her Majesty spent half an hour underground getting a taste of life at the coal face. People forget that, Jack, don't they, really?
Yes, definitely. I think... For me, those are some of the most fascinating photos in the book, are those the non-posed ones, and the ones that perhaps we haven't seen as much in other books and in other newspapers and in other varieties of published work on the Queen.
And a shameless plug once again, sorry, shameless towards the Queen at 90, A Life in Pictures, of course, available from all good news agents, news sales, and of course published by the Mortons Media Group. Can people get it online as well, Jack?
They can go to classicmagazines.co.uk, so that's our e-commerce site direct from the publisher. It's also on Amazon as of this week. Cool. So,
and Richard, have you actually seen the Her Majesty in the coal mining get-up yourself?
I do remember the photograph, or I think I remember the photograph, dating back many years. It'd be interesting, though, to see it again, because, as you mentioned, because of the scale of the archive, because there are so many iconic moments, the Queen, for example, when Princess Elizabeth making the broadcast from South Africa in 1947, or Trooping the Colour when she rode Side Saddle, those, you know, are so obvious, and yet there are others, sometimes you've just sort of jerked the memory, and I think I can recall the image. But it'd be interesting again to see it, because there is it's a treasure trove, and also it's a mirror of a changing country and friends, because of course the mining industry.
But that's what really is sparking with me about this publication, Jack. It's the way it kind of reflects our cultural passage. And whether you're looking at the famous presentation of the Jules Rimet Trophy to Bobby Moore, with Jeff Hurst just behind him after, of course, that fabulous 4-2 win in 66, or whether actually you're skipping on to the joys of Chapter 9 at United States President Gerald Ford dancing with Queen Elizabeth II during a state dinner held in Her Majesty's honour on July the 7th, 1976.
But in fact, they actually were silly enough to play the tune when the lady is a tramp. Very embarrassing.
Yeah, it's not good from that point of view. And then shortly, as we've skipped into the 70s, time is as ever of the essence with this sort of thing. Attending a recording of The Good Life at BBC Television Studios in Shepherd's Bush, London, with a wonderful... You've caught Penelope Keith in mid-curtsy, I think, with Felicity Kendall and Richard Briers obviously there as well, as Paul Eddington from that point of view. So clearly working through that. Even Richard, adjacent to that, an image of Queen Elizabeth II sitting on a traditional Japanese tatami mat.
Interesting that that was one of her tours abroad. I mean, this is nothing short of vast, because she is the most travelled head of state and has visited more countries even than the late Pope John Paul. I mean, he had the record, I think, in 127 countries. I think she must be approaching 140 or something in that area. It really is amazing. Practically every Commonwealth country, and certainly a tremendous amount of goodwill, because one forgets so easily that royal trips abroad, certainly state visits, the government encourages them. They do wonders for British exports. In the days of when the Royal Yacht Britannia operated, it was decommissioned to the Queen's grief in 1997, this gave it a particularly interesting commercial edge, because it really, really worked for British trade, but also goodwill too, and state visits to Britain are very memorable from that point of view. Although there have been monsters, Ceausescu, Mugabe...
We'll skip neatly over July the 29th, 1981. It was a certain wedding that took place with Prince Charles and Lady Diana Spencer, and move to November the 1st, 1983, in which Queen Elizabeth II met Mother Teresa in New Delhi, India. And then subsequently, a few years later, 1989, the fallout from the United States invasion of Grenada aside, Queen Elizabeth II enjoyed a strong personal relationship with President Ronald Reagan during his time in office, and bestowed a knighthood upon him at Buckingham Palace on June the 14th, 1989. Her Majesty pictured alongside Mr. Reagan and his wife Nancy, who sadly, of course, passed away recently. But again, it shows the sort of notion in terms of that tightrope of not being able to comment on politics, but at the same time being an excellent ambassador, is really critical. And Jack, your thoughts on that as an American studies student or graduate?
Yes, certainly. And it's very interesting, I think, in the areas where the Queen is able to, even if not comment, exert some influence by her presence and who she meets. I think it seems to have been done in a very clever and astute way, and in other ways she's managed to remain separate from that political
environment. Well, she has to. I mean, there's absolutely no doubt the monarchy must be above politics.
Yes.
Any member of the royal family making a political comment, or even in what might be considered an intrusion into a field which could be controversial, and the Prince of Wales, of course, skates on quite thin ice sometimes with GM crops and so forth.
What was your first royal wedding that you can remember, Jack?
Myself would... the first major televised one would be probably be William and Kate.
Yeah,
but that's only because there'd be a gap between...
You see, mine was Princess Anne and Mark Phillips, which probably shows one's chronologically the giftedness. What about yourself, Richard? What was your first royal wedding that you can actually remember experiencing?
Well, it's obviously the one you mentioned. If you look at Princess Anne and Captain Mark Phillips, and you see the interviews these days, my goodness gracious me, it shows how things have changed. Indeed, if you look before the wedding of the Prince of Wales to Lady Diana Spencer, I mean, you look at those two posed, very awkward interviews, one in which the Prince uttered the fateful words, whatever in love means, when he was asked if he was in love. I mean, both of them really make you cringe now. I mean, it shows how embryonic the interview with anybody royal was in those days, and how things are so much more polished and professional, and have been for a long time.
I think iconic is what I'd give as an adjectival term to describe many of these images. Coming almost right up to, the 90s, good grief, we're not here. November the 11th, 1998, French President Jacques Chirac joining Queen Elizabeth II for a joint unveiling of a statue of Sir Winston Churchill. It really demonstrates, Richard, just how many prime ministers Her Majesty the Queen has kind of effectively seen through.
Yeah, well, I mean, 12 have served her, and indeed the popularity and the interest in this, it's important because we were dealing with the non-political aspect of the monarchy, which is essential, and the fact that, of course, the Queen has to sign bills before they become law, and she reads the government's speech when she opens Parliament, but she chooses the theme of the Christmas broadcast herself, and of course there are the weekly audiences with the Prime Ministers, and there, and we saw this, the fascination reflected in it in the popular play with the audience, which I thought was extremely good, where any subject can come up, and it's convention that when talking to the Queen, unless it's a light-hearted conversation or you've received an honour and simply want to make more memorable what you've said and what the Queen has said to you, that you don't repeat anything that might be controversial.
What is said in the palace remains in the palace, or words to that effect. I'm particularly fond of two interviews towards the latter stages. One is where United States President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama are welcomed to Buckingham Palace by Her Majesty on April 1st, 2009. No, it wasn't an April Fool joke. And also the one wearing 3D glasses.
Yes, that's one of my favourite pictures in the whole book, and I think it reflects what Richard's talking about as well.
Was this the one in Canada?
Yes, the Canada one is there, but yes, this was wearing 3D glasses as well as piloting a JCB digger during a visit to the University of Sheffield. Phenomenal.
Yes, definitely. So, and I think it reflects what Richard's talking about in terms of the, and it certainly shone through in the book and the research that I did, the sort of change of tack from the 2000s onwards. I think in the wake of the Princess Diana's funeral and death and what came from that, and a real change of approach to public life by the royal family, in particular the Queen.
I'm not going to ask you to select your favourite image, Jack, unless you specifically want to say I'd go for that particular number.
There is one that's my favourite, and I shall...
Whilst Jack's looking for his favourite image, I'll just actually flag this up with Richard. I'm sure you'd be over this all over in many ways in your Royal Correspondent Guides for CNN and more, Richard. But on June the 12th, 2016, 10,000 guests will join members of the Royal Family to attend a huge street party on the Mall outside Buckingham Palace in honour of Queen Elizabeth II's 90th birthday.
There will be 3 days of celebration. They will have gone to St Paul's Cathedral on service of Thanksgiving on the Friday, the Trooping the Colour will be on the Saturday, and the lunch will be on the Sunday, and it'll certainly be a magnificent spectacle. There's quite a lot of controversy about the way that's been handled, as the Queen's grandson Peter Phillips has organised it, and some felt that the public shouldn't have to pay for some of the tickets, and that could have been raised by sponsorship, and I'm surprised...
Richard, it wouldn't be British if we didn't haggle over the cost. It's what we do. It's a matter of routine. I mean, you know, I just... And I'm amazed that actually this entire delightful The Queen at 90, A Life in Pictures, surely there's a decimal point wrong here, Jack. Surely it should be £69.90, not £6.99.
Well, that would be nice, wouldn't it?
Outrageous. What is your favourite image, Jack?
My favourite image is on page 63, and I think this harks back to my American studies days, but it's the members of the royal family and relatives of President John F. Kennedy stood in silence as a memorial was dedicated to him here in Britain. And the reason I think it's my favourite picture is that you can just see on the right-hand side of the picture Prince Philip holding the hand of John F. Kennedy Jr. As they dedicate the memorial. And I just think that's a fantastic moment captured in time. But I think, obviously, with my American studies history, I'm probably biased towards that picture, but...
It's probably, there's been lots of sort of characters there. Jacqueline Kennedy, John Kennedy Jr., as you mentioned, Caroline Kennedy, and we even have Patricia Lawford Kennedy, Senator Robert Kennedy, Joan Bennett Kennedy. I mean, the whole Kennedys, and the tragedy, of course, that the Kennedys actually underwent later in the year, nothing to do with the Kennedys as such, but there's another Morton Media Group package, which is going to be commemorating, as opposed to celebrating, commemorating the Pearl Harbor event. Jack,
indeed.
And you're looking towards that, so we sort of tease ahead. Yes. We're putting together for that. Richard, it's been an absolute delight. I won't ask you to select your favourite image from The Queen at 90, A Life in Pictures, because as yet you haven't actually seen the magazine, but we'll get it to you and we'll find out before too long what it will be. But Jack, a reminder, of course, that you, whilst we've tried to paint some pictures, etc., you really should get hold of this particular thing from Morton's Media Group directly. It's The Queen at 90, A Life in Pictures. Jack, thank you for joining us today. Richard, it must sort of be a cause for celebration that actually we, it's not just a case of, oh, yes, let's push that. You know, there's a lot of care going into publications like the one we've been discussing today in terms of, you know, shaping up this celebratory birthday.
Oh, well, you're quite right. But then it's one of the simple facts that there are over 40 countries still have monarchies. The Queen is head of state of 16 of the Commonwealth countries, and there is no doubt at all that we have the world's most high-profile monarchy. There's much more interest in the British monarch than in a monarchy than in any other, in any part of the world. And part of the reason for that is the longevity of the Queen's reign and her personal dedication. And part of the reason that is that there is a certain splendour among the pomp and the pageantry, and also the wonderful ceremonial avenue that Edward VII created in front of Buckingham Palace, which is used for anniversaries, and it really looks so impressive, where you have the balcony appearance. I'm sure that features in some of the photographs. But it's also fascinating where you have this glorious feel of colour and fashion, and in this book, and I'm delighted that there's such interest and there are so many books of similar sort. It's interesting that you mentioned, as we were saying earlier on, that you can see the trends and changes in a country mirrored in images of its monarchy, and that is the way it should be. It's very much part of our DNA, I think.